This is Muse, Science and Exploration for Inquisitive Minds. This is the March 2024 edition. It's entitled Moons Ascending. On the cover, a picture of a full moon rising over two purple flowers. I'm Jane Malucci, a volunteer reader for Chris. On the inside front cover, a landscape photo of the moon showing the footprints on the moon, and on the horizon, Earth. This page has the feature articles for this edition. Page 10, Ready, Set, Eclipse. The Total Solar Eclipse on April 8th by Meg Thatcher. 16, Don't Fly Me to the Moon, Apollo 11 and the No Moonies by Leonardi. 24, To the Moon and Beyond, NASA's New Artemis Missions by Lynn Winter. 28, The Power of Tides, The Push and Pull of Moons and Planets by Curtis Manley. 32, The Truth About Pluto, The Day It Wasn't a Planet by Charles C. Hofer. 36, New Moons of Saturn, The Recent Discovery of 63 Moons by Nick D'Alto. 42, Investigating Icy Moons, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life by Rachel Keough. We'll begin on page 6. Muse News. One of these stories is false. Can you spot which one? The answer is on page 46. At the top of the page is a picture of a squirrel sitting in a tree. Mammalogy. A squirrel's tail aids in navigation. A squirrel's tail has many uses, making it one of the handiest features of any animal. It helps the mammal to maneuver, allowing it to balance on tree limbs, jump, and soar. It's a communication tool that can declare alarm, interest, play, and joy. And it protects the animal in winter, working as a coat, a blanket, and an umbrella. As if all this weren't enough, researchers have recently found that a squirrel's tail contains magnetite receptors. These receptors indicate that squirrels use magnetic fields to navigate. Scientists have found such receptors in many animals, including certain species of shark, sea turtles, honeybees, dolphins, and some birds, such as geese and some rodents. Though scientists know some animals rely on Earth's magnetic field to navigate or orient themselves, they're still unsure how most of them do it. Is there anything a squirrel's tail can't do? There's a picture of a white parrot dipping something into a water bowl. The speech balloon says, "Okay now, Pippin, want some water with the cracker." Bird behavior. Pippin wants a cracker dipped in water. Cockatoos are a species of parrot. Unlike other parrots, their bodies are usually white or black with dabs of red, pink, or yellow. Long known as an intelligent bird, cockatoos have recently turned scientists' heads. At a lab in Vienna, Austria, researchers have been conducting several studies on cockatoos' thoughtful use of tools. But it was during a lunch break one day that a graduate student happened to watch a cockatoo dipping a toasted slice of bread called rusk into a tub of water. The tub was intended for drinking and bathing. The bird, named Pippin, was clearly softening his bread before eating it. Over time, the researchers observed a couple of other cockatoos dunking their rusk regularly, too. Others also dipped their bread, but less frequently. Scientists were impressed that the cockatoos had the wherewithal and patience to prepare their food before consuming it. Not acting right away when you want something takes self-control. Pippin and his buddies clearly have it. Astronomy. Is the universe asking us a question? In June 2023, the European Space Agency, ESA, released an image of star formations taken by the James Webb Space Telescope. Someone with sharp eyes spotted a surprise hidden in the bottom of the photo. A perfect glowing question mark. This section was enlarged and shared online. The internet exploded with jokes about distant aliens, cosmic video game quests, and more. Astronomers, however, say the familiar shape is just a coincidence and could indicate two galaxies merging with each other. So they've partially answered the question about the question mark, right? Ready for their close-up. Cats have a wide range of facial expressions. In March, the Oscars, also known as the Academy Awards, will honor the Best in Film from 2023. Next year, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences may need to consider a new acting category for non-humans. No, that won't be for AI, artificial intelligence actors, but for cats. In October, researchers announced that they have found domestic cats have 276 different facial expressions. Their means range from hostile sneers to friendly smiles. Clearly, cats are more sociable with humans and other cats than some people realize. Cats were found to move their whiskers and ears forward in friendly interactions and back during unfriendly ones. Researchers noted that cats' friendly expressions are like those made by dogs, monkeys, and humans. And the Oscar goes to health. Goodbye, painful shots. Approximately two-thirds of children and a quarter of adults strongly fear needles. This may prevent them from getting important vaccines. What if it were possible to give a vaccine without pricking a hole in the skin? Researchers at the University of Oxford in the United Kingdom have tested a new way to do this. In an experiment, they applied a liquid vaccine to the skin of mice, then blasted the liquid with sound. The sound waves caused tiny bubbles to form between skin cells. As these bubbles formed and popped, molecules of the vaccine seeped down into the skin. Meanwhile, the mice showed no signs of pain, and their skin was not damaged. More research will need to be done to see whether this method is safe and effective for people, but it's a promising step toward needle-free medical visits in the future. Moon mission suit up. Barbie helps NASA deal with moon dust. Over the years, Barbie, the famous doll, has enjoyed many occupations. She's been a fashion designer, a nurse, a veterinarian, a robotics engineer, and even an astronaut. In 2023, she not only made a big splash at movie theaters in the film Barbie, but she also served as an astronaut test subject in a real laboratory. As NASA readies a return mission to the moon's surface in 2026, scientists wanted to find an effective way to deal with moon dust. It's not just unhealthy to inhale, but it can be a real problem with spacesuits, interfering with their use and proper sealing. Researchers in Washington State dressed Barbie dolls in spacesuits made of materials similar to those that NASA's Artemis astronauts will wear. They coated the suits in volcanic ash from nearby Mount St. Helens that has a similar consistency as moon dust. Then, they sprayed the dolls with liquid nitrogen, which is extremely cold. This substance removed more than 98% of the ash and caused little to no damage to the spacesuit material. That's one small step for spacesuits, one giant success for Barbie. That's the news. Go to page 46 to see if you spotted the false story. Answers. Page 6 through 9, Muse News. The false story is, a squirrel's tail aids in navigation. Page 10. Ready, Set, Eclipse by Meg Thatcher. An Observer's Guide to the Total Solar Eclipse on April 8, 2024. The armies battled beneath the hot sun. Neither side seemed to be winning. It was May 28, 585 BCE, the sixth year of a war between the Lydians and the Medes on what is now Turkey. Suddenly, the light grew thin and the air turned cold. A hole appeared in the sky where the sun should be, surrounded by a halo of light. Surely, this was a sign from the gods that they should make peace. A total eclipse of the sun, as those ancient armies witnessed, could be frightening if you didn't know it was coming. That fear could even stop a war. Nowadays, we know what causes eclipses. We can predict when and where they'll happen, down to the minute and mile. Instead of frightening people, an eclipse can bring millions of us together in a wondrous moment of awe. What causes an eclipse? Earth orbits the sun, and the moon orbits Earth. The moon passing between the sun and Earth causes a solar eclipse. Although the moon is roughly 400 times smaller than the sun, it's about 400 times closer to Earth. That means they look the same size when viewed from Earth. During an eclipse, the moon casts a fuzzy shadow on the Earth. The center part of the shadow is called the umbra. People in the umbra see a total eclipse. For these viewers, darkness falls as the moon entirely covers up the sun. The gray, fuzzy part of the shadow is the penumbra. People here see a partial eclipse. The further you are from the center, the less sun is covered up. The moon takes about 27 days to orbit the Earth, but we don't have eclipses every month. That's because the moon's orbit is tilted 5 degrees to our orbit around the sun. So, the moon is often too high or too low when it's between us and the sun. An eclipse happens only when the sun, the moon, and Earth line up perfectly. The moon's orbit is an ellipse, oval, so sometimes it's closer to us and looks bigger, and sometimes it's farther away and looks smaller. If it appears too small to completely cover the sun, we'll see an annular eclipse. That's where a bright ring of light is visible around the moon. When the moon is on the opposite side of Earth from the sun, we may experience a lunar eclipse. If the sun, Earth, and the moon line up right, the full moon will cross into the Earth's shadow. Because Earth's shadow is bigger than the moon's, we see lunar eclipses more often than solar ones. Where and when to see the eclipse? On Monday, April 8, 2024, a total solar eclipse will occur across parts of North America. It will start in the South Pacific Ocean and cross into Mexico's western coast around 11:07 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. It will move diagonally north through Mexico and up into the United States in southern Texas. The eclipse will continue up into the Midwest and New England and exit North America on the Atlantic coast of Newfoundland at around 5:16 p.m., Newfoundland Daylight Time. Other parts of North America, Central America, and South America will experience a partial solar eclipse. A total solar eclipse hasn't occurred in the United States since August 2017, and before that, it was 1979. The map to the right has diagonal lines that tell you how much of the sun will be eclipsed. The path of totality, where you can see a total eclipse, is a wide yellow stripe. As in 2017, the 2024 eclipse path will cross in Carbondale, Illinois. That means those lucky folks have a chance to see a total solar eclipse again. What you'll see. James Lowenthal is an astronomy professor at Smith College in Massachusetts. He's also a former vice president of the American Astronomical Society and former member of its Solar Eclipse Task Force. He's seen multiple total, annular, and partial eclipses. He calls a total solar eclipse a deeply moving sight. When the eclipse starts, put on your eclipse glasses or use a safe viewer. Careful observers will see the moon take a little bite out of the sun. If you're not using a safe eclipse viewer to look at the sun, you won't notice anything. But around 30 minutes into the eclipse, the light will look thinner. We know how bright it should be with the sun in a clear blue sky, says Lowenthal, but it's somehow not bright enough. Because the sun is a crescent, it appears a little skinnier than usual, and shadows will look sharper. And if you look under the trees, you'll notice that the circles of light you usually see are now crescent-shaped. As the moon covers more of the sun, it will get darker out, and the temperature will drop. Animals will start getting ready for night. Birds will roost. A few minutes before totality, you may see shadow bands, wiggly stripes of light and dark that move quickly across the ground. These may occur when the light of the thin crescent sun comes through the Earth's wiggly atmosphere. Then look west. You'll see darkness, as if it's night over there and it's daytime where you are, says Lowenthal. This is the shadow of the moon rushing toward you at more than 2,000 miles, 3,200 kilometers per hour. When you can't see the sun at all through your eclipse glasses, it's safe to take them off. You may see Bailey's beads, little specks of sunlight shining between the mountains on the moon. Then you'll start to see the corona, the sun's outer atmosphere, around the moon, and one final bead of sun shining through. It's known as the diamond ring effect. Because it's only dark where you are, you'll see something like a 360-degree sunset. During totality, the corona appears like a bright crown around the black disk of the moon. The corona is about as bright as the full moon. It's shaped by the sun's magnetic fields, and it's different every eclipse. We see its inner region only with a special telescope or during a total eclipse. As your eyes adjust to the darkness, you'll see red prominences at the moon's edge. You'll see stars and planets in the sky, and all too soon, you'll see the diamond ring again, this time with the single bright bead on the other side of the sun. You may see shadow bands again, and the moon's shadow running off to the east. The eclipsed sun will suddenly be bright again. You'll need to put your eclipse glasses back on to protect your eyes. Cover up cameras and telescopes you're using with correct filters, too. The birds will wake up and start singing as if it's morning. The light will get stronger. When the last little bite of the moon disappears, everything will be back to normal. If you're not on the path of totality, you may still see the partially eclipsed sun and crescent shadows under the trees. You may observe a temperature drop, weird animal behavior, and planets in the daytime sky. But if you are able to get to the path of totality, you should. There's nothing else like it. How to observe safely. You should never look directly at the sun, even if the moon is blocking most of it. Your eye's lens focuses light on your retina, the part that detects light. And because the retina doesn't have any pain receptors, you can hurt your eyes without even knowing it. There are two simple ways to see an eclipse without risking damage to your eyes. Solar viewing glasses. These are not sunglasses. They're usually made of cardboard with specific filters that block out 99.99% of the sun's light. Make sure your solar viewing glasses or eclipse glasses meet the ISO 12312-2 standard. Before using them, hold them up to an indoor light to look for scratches and holes. If you find any, throw those glasses out. It is not safe to view the eclipse through things like sunglasses, potato chip bags, video game boxes, or smoked glass. Even if they look dark, they could be letting in ultraviolet light. You can't see it, but UV light will harm your eyes. If you look through a telescope, binoculars, or a camera, it's even more important to have a filter on the main lens. You can place a pair of eclipse glasses on your phone's camera, but Lowenthal says you don't want to fiddle with equipment too much. Enjoy the experience of totality. Pinhole projector. The simplest pinhole projector is made of two white paper plates. Poke a tiny round hole in one of them using a thumbtack. Standing with your back to the sun, hold the plate with the hole at about shoulder height. Place the intact plate in its shadow. The pinhole will project an image of the sun on the bottom plate. Don't look through the pinhole at the sun. You can make a fancier pinhole camera using a shoebox. Look for natural pinholes, like trees, during the eclipse, or Try lacing your fingers together and see how many eclipse images you can make on a white surface. Try punching out your name or a pattern in the paper plate projector. You can also draw the eclipse, journal it, and share it on social media. Here's hoping you get to see the total solar eclipse of 2024. Where will you be on April 8th? Meg Thatcher is an astronomer who lives in Western Massachusetts. She saw her first total eclipse with the last total solar eclipse in North America on August 21st, 2017. Page 16, Don't Fly Me to the Moon by Leela Nargi. Was it a conspiracy? Nope, but no moonies are skeptical anyway. About 250 miles, 400 kilometers, up in the blisteringly hot thermosphere, Russian cosmonauts are drinking espresso and looking down at our watery blue planet from the International Space Station, ISS. At NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration facilities, around the United States, scientists and engineers are busily making complicated components for a crewed mission to Mars. And in Japan, a construction company says that by the year 2050, it will complete a space elevator that will travel up a cable from the Earth's surface to a height of almost 60,000 miles, 96,000 kilometers. Conquering the cosmos? Yeah, we've got this. Only here on Earth, some folks think we never even set foot on the moon. That never happened. No moony conspiracy theorists believe that the Apollo 11 mission was a giant NASA hoax. Apollo 11's rocket, Saturn V, launched from Cape Kennedy in Florida on July 16, 1969, carrying astronauts Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Edwin Buzz Aldrin. 4 days later, Armstrong and Aldrin arrived via a lunar module called the Eagle on the moon's Sea of Tranquility. These two Americans became the first people ever to walk on our planet's only natural satellite. Except non-moonies insist it never happened. They claim that the Apollo 11 mission, over budget and plagued by technical problems, was scrapped at the last second and filmed in a movie studio in Nevada. They say they have the facts to prove it. Their facts mostly have to do with photographs the astronauts brought back to Earth. No moonies point out that there are no stars visible in the sky. Certainly, they say, there would have been stars. Also, the shadows in the photos are not parallel. Instead, they stretch in different directions. Because, they argue, there is only one light source on the moon, the sun, the shadows must have been cast by multiple lights in that movie studio. Third, but not finally, because the no-moonies have lots more facts up their sleeves. The American flag planted on the surface of the moon appears to be flapping. There's no atmosphere, and there's no wind on the moon. So how, they say, can a flag be flapping? Myth debunkers. If you write to the NASA historian's office to ask about all this, as this journalist did a few years ago, you will get back a weary-sounding email. NASA has fielded so many questions about the supposed moon hoax that it sent a letter and fact sheet in response to them since 1971. The letter cites the work of just a few of the many scientists who have debunked the moon hoax myth. One of those scientists is Jim Scotti, a research specialist at the Lunar and Planetary Lab at the University of Arizona. For years, he has managed a webpage dedicated to proving Apollo 11 did happen. For him, it's personal. I was almost 9 years old when I watched the moon landing on TV, and it had a profound influence on me, he says. We did the impossible. We landed on the moon. It inspired me to do more with my life. More than that, though, he says that proving that no moonies are wrong is important for science. People need to have the ability to think through what evidence actually means, he says. When we do science, we're learning about how the universe works, and every new bit of knowledge helps us understand our place in it. If we refuse to believe our past accomplishments ever occurred, we make our future accomplishments a matter for disbelief, too. How can a society grow and thrive under those conditions? Another moon hoax debunker is an astronomer named Philip Plait. He wrote a book called Bad Astronomy, which devotes an entire chapter to no-moony theories. Why? Because it's dangerous to be ignorant about science, he writes, of stars and shadows, and stars and stripes. Plait breaks down a bunch of the no-moonies' arguments, starting with the invisible stars in the Apollo 11 photographs. You can't see them, he and many other debunkers point out, simply because of the way a camera works. To take a picture of your fellow astronaut cavorting about in that bright sunlight, Plait writes, you would set your camera for a brief exposure. That's how long the shutter stays open to let light in. This is enough to capture your friend, but not enough to capture the stars in the sky behind him. The stars are faint by comparison, and they need a much longer exposure to become visible on film. Then there's the matter of the non-parallel shadows. Both Plait and Scotty say this has to do with perspective. Railroad tracks are parallel, but when we look straight down a pair of them, our eyes see them as coming together somewhere off in the distance, even though we know they never meet. Lunar shadows, too, are affected by perspective. When comparing the directions of shadows from two objects at very different distances, perspective effects can be quite large, Plait writes. This is something you can investigate right in your own front yard. It's hardly evidence of a multi-billion-dollar conspiracy, he says. Incidentally, some no-moonies seem unaware that there's actually more than one source of light on the moon. The second source is the moon itself, which reflects the sun's glow and fills in shadows. In photographs, this light can produce visually confusing results, like the ones of which we don't usually see on Earth. The issue of the waving flag was investigated on the TV show Mythbusters and was easily explained. Co-host Tori Belleci, Carrie Byron, and Grant Imahara revisited the moment that some 530 million people around the world watched on their black-and-white television sets as Armstrong and Aldrin planted the American flag in the moon dust. To do so, the Mythbusters team borrowed a vacuum chamber from NASA. Outer space is a vacuum, a condition with no atmospheric pressure, so it has no drag and no friction. They found that shaking the flag lightly as if they were planting it was enough to make it flap for a good while. It's about science and the future. Over and over, using real but simple science, debunkers have presented us with evidence that, says Scotty, allows us to confidently say that we went to the moon. It makes him slap his forehead to know non-believers still exist, no matter what proof he shows them. But it doesn't dampen Scotty's feelings about the night he watched the moon landing. While waiting for the transmission to come through, he wandered out of his house into the dark. I remember looking up at the moon, and it suddenly had a completely different impact on me, he says. I thought, wow, there are two guys up there right now. I never looked at that point of light the same way again. What that point of light promised him and so many other young science enthusiasts that night in 1969 is what's forever lost to no-moonies. And that is the promise of humankind's continued amazing and very real future in space. Why we believe what we believe, even when it's wrong. Spring break is coming, and you know you're going to be seeing your great Uncle George. This would be terrific, as Great Uncle George has a big swimming pool and four adorable puppies that can't wait to swim in it with you. Only, you know, Great Uncle George is a no Mooney. And he won't hesitate to try to convince you that Apollo 11 was all a hoax. How can you deal with that much goofy without it ruining your vacation? First, don't think of Uncle George as irrational, says Tom Stafford. He's a cognitive psychologist at the University of Sheffield in the United Kingdom. Great Uncle George is simply using a common human strategy to update his beliefs. The way beliefs work, Stafford explains, is that we don't start from scratch every time we consider evidence anew. What we already believe affects how we interpret new information. Michael Shermer is co-founder of Skeptic Magazine and the author of the books Why People Believe Weird Things and The Believing Brain. Once you have a belief in your head, he says, your brain goes into high gear to find evidence to support it. This is called confirmation bias, and everyone has it to some extent. Because we already believe one way, we ignore countering examples, he says. And if someone challenges your deep beliefs, you go on the defensive. It's so much easier to point out that they're wrong than admit you've wasted years believing in a silly theory. In short, the harder you try to convince someone they're wrong, the harder they'll often hold on to their beliefs. You'll both end up feeling frustrated. Does this mean you shouldn't try to convince Great Uncle George that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin took that moonwalk in 1969? Shermer says, nah, give it a shot. He advises that you should avoid mentioning scientific evidence, though. Instead, says Shermer, you can point out that for a conspiracy about the moon landings to have happened, it would have required thousands of people to be in on it. We know for sure that people can't keep their mouths shut, since it's the human thing to do to spill the beans. But almost 55 years later, no one has come forward to say it was a hoax. Apollo 11's success was not a sure thing. Eagle's landing on the moon on July 20, 1969, proved tricky. Onboard alarms started going off during the approach, but pioneering software engineer Margaret Hamilton had programmed the early onboard computer to complete its most important tasks first. NASA flight director Gene Kranz ordered the mission to continue. Then, Armstrong was startled to see the landing spot. A massive crater was bordered by a field of car-sized boulders. He slowed the lander's descent and steered it past this crater and another beyond. He set Eagle down on a mostly clear and level spot with less than a minute of fuel remaining. As dramatic as Armstrong and Aldrin's landing was, it was their return to the orbiting command module, Columbia, that had most concerned many NASA engineers and administrators. Katherine Johnson, a trailblazing African-American NASA mathematician, had been called on to work out the exact time Eagle needed to lift off from the moon to rejoin Columbia for the return home. With limited fuel, there was no room for error. Any deviation that didn't bring the modules together at the right moment would strand the lander and doom its two astronauts. Everybody was concerned about getting them there, Johnson later said. We were concerned about getting them back. About 21.5 hours after landing on the moon, Eagle lifted off with the two astronauts. It ascended toward Columbia, which was piloted by astronaut Michael Collins, and it docked successfully. Armstrong and Aldrin moved into Columbia before jettisoning, or discarding, Eagle. On July 24, 1969, the three astronauts safely splashed down into the Pacific Ocean near Hawaii. Leela Nargi lives in Brooklyn, New York, and writes about all kinds of science, mostly for kids. Among other books, she has written the middle grade book Mysteries of the Universe. Page 23. Do the Math, Bouncing Around by Ivars Peterson. Four-sided shapes discovered in 2017 defy the rules of unpredictability. The game of billiards, or pool, is all about geometry. You line up your shot and strike the cue ball. It caroms off the billiard table's wall and smacks into the target ball, which scoots across the table right into a pocket. That is, if you get your angles right. An expert player can figure out exactly where the ball will go. Most time, the ball travels in a straight line until it hits a wall. When it bounces, it obeys a basic law of physics. The angle between the incoming ball's path and the wall is the same as the angle of the outgoing ball's path and the wall. That's enough to predict the ball's motion, no matter how many bounces it takes. Some mathematicians like to go further by imagining what would happen if the ball never slowed down and kept rebounding endlessly, as if the table were perfectly smooth and had no pockets. What sort of paths could a ball follow? The ball could settle into a repeating pattern, even one as simple as endlessly bouncing back and forth between the opposite sides of a rectangular table. Or, under the right conditions, it could continually trace a new path, eventually covering the entire table. Mathematicians describe such a path as chaotic. The shape of the table makes a difference. What if, for example, you have a four-sided, arrow-shaped table with corners that are not right angles? On such a table, a bouncing ball could follow a chaotic path in one part of the table without ever reaching every part of the table. That makes it impossible for mathematicians to predict all the types of paths a ball could follow on a given four-sided table. Or does it? In August 2017, a team of mathematicians announced that they had found, to their surprise, two families of four-sided shapes, or quadrilaterals, having particular angles that make it impossible to figure out every billiard path that can occur within them. They serve as extremely rare exceptions to the rule of unpredictability. These quadrilaterals are shown above. They both look a bit like darts with two fins in the back and a point on the opposite side. No one knows yet whether there might be similar examples out there. Understanding motion on weirdly shaped tables is part of deeper studies of how things move. This includes the study of real objects such as moons and asteroids, which are tugged by the sun and nearby planets as they orbit in space. How do their orbits change over thousands or millions of years? Could our moon or a stray asteroid end up on a collision course with Earth? Geometry helps us answer those questions. If you have access to a pool table or some other flat surface with walls, you might want to experiment with how barriers of different shapes affect a ball's motion. For example, try setting a large circular object in the middle of the table. You'll probably find that figuring out where a ball will end up on the table is no simple matter. Ivars Peterson is a freelance writer, blogger, and author of The Mathematical Tourist. He is intrigued by the notion that simple changes in geometry can have a huge effect on the predictability of how things move. Page 24, To the Moon and Beyond by Lynn Winter. NASA's Artemis program is set to return humans to the moon after more than half a century. In the bottom right of this page, there are three pictures regarding the Artemis mission. The top on the left is a picture of the Artemis aircraft with the Earth in the lower right corner. The caption reads, "In late 2022, the uncrewed Artemis 1 Orion spacecraft successfully flew to the moon and beyond." At the top right, an illustration of a starship. The caption reads, "A NASA illustration shows the starship HLS, which will deliver astronauts to the moon as part of the Artemis 3 mission." And at the very bottom of the page, four of the astronauts for the Artemis mission. The caption reads, The four NASA astronauts who will travel around the moon as part of the Artemis II mission are, from left to right, Mission Specialist Jeremy Hansen, Pilot Victor Glover, Commander Reid Wiseman, and Mission Specialist Christina Koch. More than 50 years ago, on December 11, 1972, two U.S. astronauts from the Apollo 17 lunar landing mission, Gene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt, became the most recent humans to step onto the gray, dusty, and rocky surface of the moon. Today, NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, is partnering with international space agencies and commercial enterprises to make the 238,855-mile, 384,400-kilometer return trip a reality in the 2020s. They're calling it the Artemis program. It's named after the Greek goddess of the moon and the twin sister of the Greek god Apollo. Apollo was the name of NASA's first illustrious lunar space program. It brought humans to the moon for the first and last times with a total of six missions. As early as 2026, the Artemis mission will deliver humans to the lunar surface, including the first woman and first person of color. Later missions of this program will allow us to keep a presence on the moon for an extended period of time. Astronauts and scientists will dive into the 4.5 billion-year-old time capsule, as some refer to the moon. Our goal is to make even more distant human spaceflight missions a reality. Piece by piece, we're making the impossible within reach, says Marcresia Albarujo. She helps lead NASA's human research program, studying the impact of spaceflight on human bodies and behavior to keep astronauts healthy. NASA has planned five Artemis missions, four of them crewed. The uncrewed mission was already a success in late 2022. The first crewed Artemis mission, which will swing around the moon but not land, is set to launch in September 2025. What's learned during these missions will inform the next giant leap in space exploration, sending astronauts to Mars, hopefully, in the 2030s. The moon will be a testing ground for new technologies and equipment ahead of the approximately three-year round-trip journey to the Red Planet. Mars averages a distance of 140 million miles, 225 million kilometers from Earth. But the number varies depending on where the two planets are in their orbits around the Sun, something mission planners carefully factor into their calculations. Justin Darnall is a senior manager of software development at Blue Origin, one of the aerospace companies involved in the Artemis program. You can't launch to Mars, says Darnall. You have to be a perfect quarterback with the perfect pass to meet Mars where it will be. Returning to the moon, according to NASA, will also build upon our knowledge of space. What we learn, they say, will further scientific discovery and technological advancements, advance new industries, and support job growth and inspire a new generation of explorers, the Artemis generation. Fasten your seatbelts. An exciting new chapter in human space exploration is about to begin. Artemis missions 1 to 5. Artemis 1. This uncrewed flight test launched on November 16, 2022, traveling toward the moon and beyond and returning to Earth for a total of 1.4 million miles, 2.3 million kilometers. It splashed down into the Pacific Ocean on December 11, 2022. This mission carried three mannequins dressed in sensor-fitted spacesuits to provide data about the astronaut experience. Also on board were Shaun the Sheep and Snoopy plushies as zero-gravity indicators, floating when the spacecraft reached the weightlessness of microgravity. The success of this mission helped show that the various systems will make a moon mission suitable for astronauts. Artemis 2, no earlier than September 2025. The 10-day flight and first crewed mission will test human deep space exploration capabilities, the Space Launch System SLS rocket, and the Orion spacecraft. four astronauts will conduct a lunar flyby, confirming the spacecraft systems operate correctly before using Earth's natural gravitational pull to return home. Artemis 3, no earlier than September 2026. The first crewed mission landing since Apollo 17 will make history by delivering the first woman and the first person of color to the lunar surface. While two other astronauts from the mission orbit the moon, the two astronauts will spend nearly a week on the moon conducting studies at the lunar South Pole. Artemis 4, planned 2028. The International Habitation Module, the main living area, will be delivered to Gateway, the small moon station outpost. Astronauts will make a second moon landing, perform research, and collect samples. Artemis 5, planned 2029. The Esprit refueling module will be delivered to Gateway. Astronauts will visit the moon to work and explore. Lynn Winter is a writer from Highlands Ranch, Colorado. She likes to gaze at the night sky and contemplate her place in the universe. Page 26, Science at Work, by Lynn Winter. Justin Darnall, aerospace engineer. Throughout history, people have had some curious ideas about the moon. Some see a face or a rabbit on the surface. Others believe the moon can bring good luck. There's even a myth that a full moon can help turn humans into werewolves. When Justin Darnall looks up at the moon, he sees the future of space travel and exploration. Darnall is an aerospace engineer, someone involved in the design, development, testing, and production of aircraft and spacecraft. He has worked on both systems and equipment. Today, he works for Blue Origin, a private spaceflight company and aerospace manufacturer. Jeff Bezos, famous for founding Amazon, started Blue Origin in the year 2000. Darnall is a senior manager of software development, testing, and deploying for lunar permanence at Blue Origin's offices in Denver, Colorado. He and his team are developing software for the Human Landing System, HLS. It will be used to deliver humans to the moon's surface as part of NASA's Artemis 5 mission. Did you grow up dreaming of a career in aerospace? Yes, I dreamt of being an astronaut. Then, during my senior year of high school, I wrote about how cool it would be to become an aerospace engineer, not knowing it was something I could actually pursue. I thought it was a thing of the past, until I returned to college after serving 8 years in the Marine Corps. In college, I majored in aerospace systems engineering. I was fascinated by the mechanical side of things and wanted to build rockets. I fell in love with software when the company where I gained work experience as an intern assigned me to their flight software guidance, navigation, and control team. Can you describe your job? I oversee software development for the Blue Moon Mark II single-launch lunar cargo lander, which will remain on and provide access to the moon's surface. I also work on the Mark II human landing system, which will deliver humans to the moon. How we develop software, software processes and procedures, compliance to standards, and how we present and test the software are in my scope of work. Why is it important to travel to the moon? Everything we do, from manufacturing to travel, drains Earth's finite, limited resources. It's not a sustainable future. Creating this software will allow us to preserve our planet by tapping into the infinite resources of space. It starts with building a lunar space station from which shuttles can launch, making space travel more convenient, environmentally friendly, and sustainable than it would be if they were coming from Earth. Ordinarily, burning rocket fuel dumps carbon emissions into the atmosphere, and many rockets are not reusable, which adds to the pollution on Earth and in orbit. Launching from the moon's lower gravitational field requires less energy, equaling less pollution. We're developing and launching reusable rockets that use hydrogen and oxygen as fuel, with water as the only byproduct. The moon has hydrogen and water, making it a sustainable fuel source. How soon will people be living and working on the moon? And where do we go from there? Once we can get to the moon safely, consistently, and frequently, the ability to build a lunar base will grow exponentially. It won't be more than 2 decades after that before we have people living on the moon, hopefully less than 30 years from now. The moon will prepare us for future astronaut missions to Mars and become a jumping-off point for exploring the galaxy. Our vision is a future where millions of people are living and working in space for the benefit of Earth. What would you tell young people intimidated by the idea of working in the aerospace industry? There is nothing special about me. I put in a lot of effort to be good at what I do, and others have helped me along the way. You don't have to be a genius. I'm not. The job opportunities are limitless. We need engineers, writers, business people, artists, botanists, technicians, accountants, etc. For example, once interplanetary travel is possible and we live on different celestial bodies, we'll need people to build houses and structures. We can't send enough food, so someone needs to plant it. There isn't a profession that won't translate to aerospace. Lynn Winter is a writer from Highlands Ranch, Colorado. Her son Tyler was born during a full moon, but she's pretty sure he's not a werewolf. Wait, where is that howling coming from? Page 28, The Power of Tides by Curtis Mank. The push and pull of moons with their host planets. Imagine a planet that spins so fast a day lasts not 24 hours, but only 6. Daytime is brief, and nighttime is only long enough for a nap. The planet's moon rushes across the sky so close it looks 10 times larger than our familiar moon. No, this is not one of the Earth-like planets astronomers have discovered around distant stars. It is Earth itself, 4.5 billion years ago, when the moon was newly formed and orbiting less than 20,000 miles, 32,200 kilometers from Earth. Since then, the power of the tides has slowed Earth's spin and pushed the moon's orbit more than 200,000 miles, 322,000 kilometers farther away. Other tidal forces have affected many of the solar system's moons. They have controlled their orbits, slowed their spins, melted their interiors, and, in the case of Jupiter's moon Io, driven continuous volcanism, rise and fall of oceans and land. Tides on Earth are caused by the gravitational pulls of both the moon and sun. The moon, though, is much closer, and its pull is twice that of the sun. Tides on Earth affect more than just the oceans. Though you never notice it, twice each day, the solid rock under your feet rises and falls about 15 inches, 38 centimeters. The main tidal bulge caused by the moon's gravity should point directly toward the moon, but it doesn't. Earth's fast rotation keeps the tidal bulge ahead of the moon, so the gravity of the bulge pulls the moon faster in its path around Earth. Because of this extra pull, the moon spirals away from Earth about 1.5 inches, 3.8 centimeters each year to find a stable orbit. But gravity works both ways. While Earth's tidal bulge pulls the moon forward, the moon's backward tug on the bulge slows Earth's spin and makes our day longer. These evolutionary changes in the moon's orbit and the length of Earth's days were figured out in 1878 by George Darwin. He was following in the footsteps of his father, Charles Darwin, whose groundbreaking book, On the Origin of Species, described the evolutionary changes of plants and animals over time. George Darwin's explanation of the Earth and Moon's tidally entwined history became even more relevant starting in 1979. That's when the Voyager spacecraft began studying the moons of Jupiter and the other outer planets. Slowing spinning moons. Friction from the tides rise and fall slows a moon's spin until it keeps the same face toward its host planet at all times. This stable configuration is called a tidal lock. all the solar system's large moons, including Earth's, are tidally locked. Pluto and its largest moon, Charon, are in a mutual or double tidal lock. This means that the rotation of each of them takes exactly the same amount of time, so each presents the same face to the other. Cosmic tug of war. Two or more moons can also tidally interact in what is called an orbital resonance. This interaction causes the moon's orbits to change shape and their orbital periods to become simple ratios of each other. An orbital period is the time it takes one body to make a complete orbit around another. For example, in the time it takes the moon Ganymede to orbit Jupiter once, the moon Europa orbits twice, and Io orbits four times. This gives a ratio of orbital periods of 1 to 2 to 4. The resonance is maintained by the three moons tugging at one another on every orbit. Just a little squeeze. A moon with a non-circular orbit, or one in resonance with other moons, is subject to continuously varying tidal forces. This constant squeezing and relaxing creates friction that heats the moon's interior. In the case of Io, intense tidal heating has put this moon through an extreme makeover, boiling away its water and energizing its volcanoes. It is the most active place in the solar system, says planetary volcanologist Rosalie Lopez. She's a senior research scientist and manager at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Other moons also show volcanism caused by tidal heating. Where we really see active volcanism is Io and Saturn's moon Enceladus, says Lopez. Volcanism has occurred at least in the past on Neptune's moon Triton, Europa, Ganymede, and other moons. She adds that there is an indication of volcanic activity on Saturn's largest moon, Titan, first found in data gathered by the Cassini space probe. Images also show a haze over surface formations that appear to be lava flows. And more recent research suggests a heat source could exist within this moon. Life under ice? Since Titan is an icy world, its volcanism differs from that of either Io or Earth. Lava on Titan is probably a mixture of water and ammonia, says Lopez. It erupts onto the surface as liquid, then begins to cool and crystallize. Eruptions of watery lavas onto the surfaces of icy moons show that tidal heating can create liquid oceans under a surface layer of ice. It also suggests those oceans might offer ideal places for life to exist. Multiple countries are sending space missions to discover whether primitive life ever evolved within these moons and whether any lives there now. A moon's end. Remember that our moon is spiraling away because Earth's tidal bulge pulls it faster in its orbit. But what about Mars's moon Phobos, which orbits faster than Mars spins, or Neptune's moon Triton, which has a retrograde orbit? This is an orbit in which the moon moves in the direction opposite to the planet's spin. In these cases, the planet's tidal bulges slow down the moon, making it spiral toward the planet. Uh-oh. Yep, someday Phobos will crash into Mars. But don't hold your breath. It might not happen for another 100 million years. Curtis Manley lives near Seattle, Washington, with his wife, daughter, and cat. He enjoys beachcombing after a high tide. The volcanoes he studied in graduate school all came with breathable atmosphere and dirt roads for easy access. Page 31, Q&A by Lizzie Wade. Question, will humans evolve in the future? Audrey, age 11, California. Answer, there is no doubt in my mind, says Chris Tyler Smith, a geneticist at the Wellcome Sanger Institute in the United Kingdom. He has collected and studied data on genetic variation in humans and related species, such as gorillas and chimpanzees. human evolution happens through a process called natural selection. That means people with a particular trait have more babies than people without that trait, and those babies survive to have more babies themselves. As long as some people die before they have children, natural selection will be influencing who survives and reproduces, says Tyler Smith. Human evolution usually takes a while, like millions of years, before clear changes become apparent. But sometimes it can happen in just a few thousand years, especially when people move into challenging new environments. For example, people living in the Himalayas, in Tibet, in East Asia, and in the Andes in South America have unique versions of certain genes that help them live at the high altitudes of some of the world's tallest mountains. The few thousand years it took to evolve these changes is the blink of an eye compared to the 300,000 years or so that the species Homo sapiens has existed. Peter Vischer is a geneticist at the University of Queensland in Australia. He wanted to see if anything like that was happening now, so he used a huge database to study the genes, health, and life stories of 500,000 people in the UK. Among other things, he found that shorter women tended to have more children than taller women. For men, it was the opposite. Taller men fathered more babies than shorter men. But that doesn't mean all men in the UK will eventually become taller and all women shorter, he says. Unlike the genetic changes that help people live at high altitudes, height is not determined by one or two genes. For a trait like human height, we think there's probably 10,000 or more genes that each have a tiny effect, like a fraction of an inch, he says. Each of those genes probably affects other traits, too, so their exact influence on what you look like and how you act is still a mystery. That means that although Vischer can pick up hints that humans are still evolving, he has no idea what the results of that evolution will be. If you want to predict what people will look like, what will have changed in 100 or 1,000 years, that is, in my view, impossible to say, Vischer says. Lizzie, have a question? Send them to Muse, Q&A, 1 East Erie Street, Suite 525, PMB 4136, Chicago, Illinois, 60611, or email them to muse@cricketmedia.com. Page 32, The Truth About Pluto, by Charles C. Hofer. Then one day it wasn't a planet. The end. Once upon a time, Pluto was a planet. Then one day it wasn't a planet. The end. That might be the world's worst bedtime story, but it's also 100% true. Following its discovery in 1930, little Pluto captured the imagination of anyone who looked skyward and wondered about the farthest edges of our solar system. Some people preferred Pluto to the ringed beauty of Saturn or the galactic girth of Jupiter. The man who discovered Pluto went from a small-town hero to a national legend nearly overnight. Pluto, the smallest of planets, became a lovable symbol of any underdog. Then, in 2006, astronomers stripped Pluto of its planet status and labeled it a dwarf planet. Whatever that was. Pluto's 76-year run as a planet was over. The story of Pluto is about how things change. Specifically, it's about how things change in light of new evidence. Pluto's story is a story about science. The dawn of science. Today, we take it for granted, but science, as we know it, has thrived in the Western world for only a little more than 300 years. Prior to that, people often guessed at how the natural world worked. The reason the sun rises and sets, why birds disappeared during the winter months, how we sicken, how we heal. Educated guesses, traditions, and religious faiths explained all these natural phenomena. No rigorous way existed to test new ideas about our world. Then, stargazers started to notice that heavenly objects didn't behave the way tradition said they would. In the early 1500s, Polish astronomer Nicholas Copernicus proposed an idea that shook the world. He suggested that the Earth and all the other planets revolve around the sun instead of the other way around. Many refused to accept Copernicus's idea. A century later, Italian astronomer Galileo Galilei revisited Copernicus's ideas, this time with the help of more advanced telescopes. By observing the movement of planets, Galileo proved Copernicus's theory correct. Galileo's work is an early example of the scientific method in action. These observations turned Copernicus's hypothesis into a proven theory, says Veronica Bray Durfee. She's a planetary scientist at the University of Arizona and has contributed to various NASA missions, including the New Horizons spacecraft that flew past Pluto in 2015. It shows that no matter how unpopular a result, scientists will update their opinions in light of newly discovered information. The scientific method provides a framework to subject new ideas to rigorous testing. Using this method, scientists test and improve their ideas, called hypotheses or theories, by performing experiments or making observations. Only after passing these tests can ideas become accepted scientific knowledge. Most important to Pluto's story, the method calls for scientists to re-examine old ideas in light of new evidence. This evidence might arise from a fresh discovery or a technological innovation. The scientific method provides a tool to question everything that we assume to be true, even the number of planets in our solar system. The search for Planet X. By the 20th century, astronomy had come a long way since the days of Copernicus. Advances in telescopes and other technologies led to discoveries of distant moons and comets and other space bodies. But scientists had observed only 8 planets. Some astronomers were convinced that another planet lay beyond Neptune. This mysterious planet became known as Planet X. In 1930, while working in the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, young astronomer Clyde Tombaugh tested some planet-hunting techniques. By applying some new tweaks to old methods, he shed light on the darkest corners of our solar system. Before long, Tombaugh discovered Planet X. An 11-year-old in England named Venetia Burney suggested calling the planet Pluto. The world celebrated. Our solar system was complete. Even as Pluto gained recognition as a planet, however, doubt began to arise. The planets in our solar system fall into 2 main categories. First, there are terrestrial planets of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. These planets are small and solid, made of rock and ice. They are close to the sun. Then there are gas giants, represented by Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. These planets are massive, ringed, and composed mainly of gas. While the terrestrial planets and the gas giants are different from one another, all planets clearly fall into one category or the other. Pluto, however, does not. Naysayers argued that tiny Pluto didn't deserve planet status. Pluto was too much of an oddball. Others argued that the little celestial body had enough characteristics that other official planets possessed. Astronomers debated back and forth about the true nature of Pluto. The noes have it. It all began to unravel for Pluto in 2005. The Kuiper Belt, an area at the edge of our solar system, is home to countless space rocks, large and small, including Pluto. Many astronomers believe the Kuiper Belt is made up of debris that drifted away when our solar system was formed. Astronomer Mike Brown of the California Institute of Technology was convinced that rocks the size of Pluto, and perhaps even larger, exist in the Kuiper Belt. In 2005, he finally found one. It's called Eris. Now that Pluto was considered one large object in the Kuiper Belt, among others, its days as a planet were numbered. At the annual meeting of the International Astronomers Union, IAU, a year later, astronomers present held a vote. Is Pluto a planet? The answer was a clear no. The IAU voted to change Pluto's status, and that was the end of Pluto as the ninth planet. The end? Of course, an entire planet can't just vanish. The IAU demoted Pluto to a dwarf planet, a new classification that includes Eris and fellow Kuiper Belt dwellers. The world reacted in dismay. After all, for many, tiny Pluto had become their favorite planet. But science isn't a popularity contest. Pluto was the first Kuiper Belt object discovered, says Bray. Over time, more and more Kuiper Belt objects were discovered. We realized we had it wrong all along. New evidence about the Kuiper Belt allowed scientists to re-examine what they thought they knew about our solar system. As a result, they updated how they classify planets. For Pluto, the rules of the game had changed. Once you get to see the variety of worlds that are out there, you realize that it doesn't matter what it's called, says Bray. Pluto is still as cool and complex as it ever was. Science keeps moving forward. Today's scientists are asking questions that the next generation will answer. And you never know. With new scientists applying fresh ideas, the story of a possible ninth planet is far from finished. Charon is Pluto's largest moon. Pluto has five natural satellites, or moons. The largest is Charon. It's half the size of Pluto, making it the largest known satellite in proportion to its parent body in the solar system. Many large round moons like our own continuously show the same face to their planet as they orbit. It's a phenomenon known as tidal locking. Charon and Pluto, though, have a rarer relationship called mutual tidal locking. This means that Pluto always shows Charon the same face, too. So while some parts of Pluto would never see Charon in the sky, in other regions this moon would always be visible. Charles C. Hofer is a biologist living in New Mexico. There, he has been waiting patiently for the IAU to reconsider its decision about Pluto. Page 36, New Moons of Saturn by Nick D'Alto. A new discovery is changing the way we think about the moons in our solar system. Tiny, lumpy, and whizzing around their planet in all directions. And that's not just one or two of them, but an entire swarm. Welcome to the surprising new moons of Saturn. Astronomer Edward Ashton led the team that recently discovered an astonishing 63 tiny new natural satellites orbiting around the sixth planet from the sun. His findings pushed Saturn past Jupiter for the most moons in our solar system. No one has ever found this many moons before. Ashton only located the new moons by breaking many of the unwritten rules about how and where to search for moons and how they should be expected to behave. He began this research while a graduate student at the University of British Columbia in Canada, and now works at Academia Sinica Institute of Astronomy and Astrophysics in Taiwan. His discoveries may change the way we look at all moons, including our own. Why keep searching? Astronomers have been finding moons in orbit around Saturn for centuries. It began not long after the introduction of the telescope, which happened in 1608. Dutch science pioneer Christian Huygens discovered the first known moon of Saturn in 1655. It was named Titan. By using ever more powerful instruments over the years, astronomers found nearly 100 more moons. So, why expect to find even more than that? Based on a planet's size and other traits, we can estimate how the moons that orbit around that planet should vary in size and what percentage are big and small, Ashton explains. For Saturn, smaller moons were still missing from the total. tough to spot. But these missing moons around Saturn would prove difficult to spot. They'd be very small and dim, Ashton says. Plus, they'd be moving rapidly, so they wouldn't stay in the same place long. Their movements make the moons too faint to appear in a still photograph, even when taken using a powerful telescope. And longer exposures would just show nearly meaningless streaks. Even the Voyager and Cassini satellites, which flew past Saturn, Ashton says, failed to notice these moons. A new way to look. To finally spot these elusive orbiters, Ashton and his team used a cutting-edge technique called shift and stack. This involved first taking many images through a telescope of regions around Saturn where the moons might be. They obtained a total of 44 images for each 3-hour period. Then, based on how the moons should be moving, each image was shifted. So the spot where moons should appear landed in the same place in each frame. There was still nothing to see. Each moon image remained too dim, but the researchers overlapped the images and carefully aligned them. These fuller pictures revealed moons that were bright enough to see. This method had been used before to find moons around other planets, Ashton says, but never around a giant planet like Saturn, where there is so much more space to explore. A different kind of moon. The moons these images captured are uncannily small. They are miniature worlds, measuring just 1 or 2 miles, 1.6 to 3.2 kilometers across. They are shaped like lumpy potatoes, as they lack sufficient mass for their gravity to make them round. They orbit very far from Saturn itself, from 6 to 18 million miles, 10 to 29 million kilometers out. On average, they are about 50 times farther away than our moon is positioned from Earth. Their orbits are unusual in other ways, too. They're extremely elongated and slanted compared to the planet's orbit. Different moons of Saturn revolve in different directions, and some moons follow one another in virtually the same orbit. This very different kind of satellite is called an irregular moon, Ashton explains. Other irregular moons had already been found orbiting Saturn before these newly discovered moons greatly increased their number. The other outer planets in our solar system, Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune, have irregular moons too. Jurassic moons? The chaotic behavior of the newly found moons also hints at the amazing way they may have been formed. Most traditional moons orbit near a planet's equator because these moons condensed and formed around the same time as the planet itself, says Ashton. But moons with slanted orbits were often comets or asteroids, which strayed too close to a planet and got captured by its gravity later on. In the case of Saturn, several large masses were probably captured into orbit about when the planet was formed, about 4.5 billion years ago. But then later collisions fractured these masses into pieces to make the many moons we see now, Ashton theorizes. Incredibly, the largest of these collisions may have occurred as recently as a few hundred million years ago. This was around the time when dinosaurs ruled our Earth. It was practically yesterday in astronomical time. When we view these moons today, we are likely seeing the broken pieces from that past collision. They are still whirling through space as the planet's gravity tugs at them. Some moons still orbit near one another, suggesting they broke apart from the same larger piece. Meanwhile, others now orbit so far from the planet that even gravity from the distant sun can alter their paths. These orbits continue to change over time. Our dynamic solar system. These new moons make Saturn an even more fascinating place. Saturn is most famous for its distinctive rings, which are made from millions of shimmering ice crystals. 10 times the size of Earth and 10 times as far from the Sun, Saturn is a gas giant, made of mostly hydrogen and helium. This means the planet has no solid surface. Because it is orbited by so many moons, some scientists liken it to a kind of mini solar system. The newly found moons also change the way we think about moons themselves. They remind us that not every moon is like our moon or the other larger, regular ones. The larger moons exert the greatest effects on their planets, Ashton says. But in terms of numbers, the most common moons in the solar system are these tiny ones. This all suggests a much more dynamic solar system. It's a place where celestial giants still jostle for position and occasionally crash into one another. And it's where natural satellites that were once too small to even be seen whiz around planets in busy swarms. Our solar system is hardly the serene, unchanging heavens people once thought. Though it is almost 5 billion years old, our solar system is still evolving. As Edward Ashton's research into Saturn's moons has shown, some of the solar system's wonders are still waiting to be discovered. So many moons. Saturn has 24 regular moons. The biggest, called Titan, is larger than the planet Mercury. Saturn also has 122 irregular moons, 63 of which were just discovered. Many of these are just a few miles across. We know most about Saturn's large, regular moons. Here are three of the most remarkable. Titan, discovered in 1655, second largest moon in the solar system. Nitrogen-rich, Earth-like atmosphere. Lakes and rivers made of liquid methane. A subsurface ocean of water and ammonia. Iapetus, pronounced Iapetus. Discovered in 1671, strangely colored, one side is jet black, the other snow white. Has mountains 6 miles, 10 kilometers high. Enceladus, pronounced Enceladus. Discovered in 1789, covered in ice, emits geysers of water vapor and ice. Astronomers think these Saturn moons may harbor life. Named for ancient gods and diverse cultures. The regular moons of Saturn are named for gods from ancient Greece. Saturn was the Roman god of agriculture. Meanwhile, the planet's irregular moons celebrate different cultures. These that orbit with the planet are named for the gods of the Inuit people of Greenland, Canada, and other parts of the Arctic, as well as for deities from ancient Ireland and Scotland. Irregular moons that orbit in the opposite direction are named for gods and heroes taken from Viking legends. Saturn's most newly discovered moons have yet to receive names. Current moon counts by planet. Earth, 1. Mars, 2. Jupiter, 95. Saturn, 146. Uranus, 27. Neptune, 14. Mercury and Venus have no moons. Back in middle school, author Nick D'Alto built a working model of the solar system and won his high school science fair. But with all these new moons, he might have run out of wire, glue, and ping pong balls. Page 40. Science at Work by Nick D'Alto. Edward Ashton, astronomer. Jupiter and Saturn had been trading the title for the most moons of any planet in the solar system. In February 2023, Jupiter, the larger planet, pulled ahead. 12 new moons had been discovered, pushing its total number of moons to 92. But just a few months later, in May, another team of astronomers announced that they had found 62 new moons orbiting Saturn, plus one moon a little earlier, bringing its total to 146 moons. This finding, which nearly doubled the number of known Saturn moons, marked the most moons ever discovered at one time. The astronomer who led the team behind the impressive Saturn moon discovery was Edward Ashton. He began this research while a graduate student at the University of British Columbia in Canada in 2019. He now works as a postdoctoral fellow at the Academia Sinica's Institute of Astronomy and Astrophysics in Taiwan. His research focuses on the solar system. Finding all these new moons wasn't exactly an overnight discovery. What was the process like? It certainly wasn't a quick discovery. I started this research almost 5 years ago. We used data taken using the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope. It's a 3.6-meter, 10.5-foot optical infrared telescope, which sits on top of Mauna Kea, a dormant volcano on the island of Hawaii. The images we used were taken over many three-hour periods between 2019 and 2021. While these were superb images, these moons were still too faint to see in them. So we used special techniques, such as one called shift and stack, to overlap the images and merge the data together to make the moons visible. Then seeing all those tiny dots around Saturn was the aha moment? Not yet. Just finding an object close to a planet doesn't guarantee it's a moon. It could be an asteroid passing near the planet. Also, objects near a planet don't always remain there. To be sure, we must track an object for several years to prove that it's really orbiting the planet. It's a very formalized process. How did you track them? Have you ever played a game of connect the dots? It was a little like that. We had to connect where an object that we thought was a moon appeared in many different images, so we could piece together how that object might be orbiting around the planet. At times, it was like playing 100 games of connect the dots on the same page, but without knowing which dot belonged to which puzzle. Had any of these moons been seen before? In fact, some of them had been spotted briefly many years ago, but hadn't been tracked long enough to prove that they traveled around the planet in stable orbits. This is easy to understand because these moons all orbit very far from the planet. They move in steeply inclined elliptical orbits that aren't always simple closed loops. Isn't it tough to keep track of them? It is tough. First, we needed to screen out Saturn's already known moons. Plus, we had to submit our findings to the Minor Planet Center, which keeps track of these kinds of natural satellites, and their archives of past sightings go back many years. So once we knew our orbits, we had to run those orbits backwards in time to see if any of our finds matched the old records. We did find a match. That was extra proof. Saturn is almost a billion miles from the Sun, yet you were able to find small moons. Yes, each moon we found is in the range of about 2 to 3 miles, 3.2 to 4.8 kilometers across. These moons are about as small as current technology can detect at that range. And that's important. It reminds us that our solar system is really a collection of objects at greatly varying scales. Page 42, Investigating Icy Moons by Rachel Keough. On April 14, 2023, a sleek rocket took off from Europe's spaceport in French Guiana in northeast South America. It blasted beyond Earth's atmosphere, soaring into the darkness of space. On board was a brand new space probe called the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, or JUICE for short. JUICE has an exciting trip ahead. It will travel through our solar system with its sights set on reaching the planet Jupiter by July 2031. This probe will be so far from Earth, hundreds of millions of miles away, that it needs a 2.5-meter, 8.2-foot antenna to send information to us back home. It is also equipped with large solar panels to provide power. Once near Jupiter, JUICE will embark on a planned 4-year mission to study the planet and its mysterious icy moons, Ganymede, Callisto, and Europa. Galileo Galilei, 1564 to 1642, first spotted these moons along with Io, which isn't icy, in 1610. It seemed as if they were all too far from the sun to have life. Space probes such as Galileo, 1989 to 2003, and Cassini, 1997 to 2017, however, have sparked fresh interest in the possibility of alien life on water-rich worlds. Galileo hinted at the existence of hidden oceans on Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, and Cassini caught Saturn's moon Enceladus shooting water plumes into space. Water could mean life. Why is water such a big deal? Scientists have spent decades looking for life in space, and they start by finding places with water, says Oliver Whittesey. He is the project scientist for European Space Agency's JUICE mission. Yet on these moons, most water appears to be trapped under a thick layer of ice. It may seem like nothing could survive in such cold, dark places, but the discovery in 2013 of microbes living in a huge lake under a thick ice sheet in Antarctica, along with the discovery in 1977 of life around vents in deep, cold, dark oceans on Earth, grabbed the attention of astronomers. That life can exist in extreme ice-covered environments on Earth left them wondering if other ice-covered objects, such as moons like Europa, Ganymede, Callisto, and Enceladus, could also harbor life. JUICE isn't the only mission on the hunt for watery worlds. In October, NASA will launch its Europa Clipper probe toward Jupiter. While JUICE will mostly concentrate on Ganymede to see if it could support life, NASA's mission will focus mainly on Europa. Also, the China National Space Administration, CNSA, is planning its own mission to launch around 2030. It will target Jupiter and its moon Callisto, with arrival expected around 2036. A world beneath ice. Scientists think Europa might have the essentials for life: water, energy, and the right chemical mix. Telescope images show Europa's surface as smooth and bright. We knew the bright material was possibly ice, says Cynthia Phillips. She's a planetary scientist working on the NASA Europa Clipper mission. A couple decades ago, scientists got a closer look at Europa with Galileo. It revealed this moon's surface is crisscrossed with tracks and ridges, just like a giant jigsaw puzzle, says Phillips, who also worked with the Galileo team. These features are caused by the movement of an ocean beneath, pushed and pulled by Jupiter's immense gravity. It's similar to how our moon makes the ocean water on Earth move. Due to Jupiter's large size, however, its gravity is much stronger. When Europa nears Jupiter, its surface lifts up by several meters, then drops back down as it moves away, creating its broken appearance, she says. Jupiter's pull does more than just shape Europa's surface. It also creates heat. Think of Europa as a squishy ball, squeezed and released by Jupiter's gravity, Phillips says. This squeezing, happening as Europa orbits Jupiter, causes tidal heating. Every time Europa gets squeezed, it heats up inside. This heat is probably what prevents Europa's ocean from freezing. Galileo's discovery of a magnetic field around Europa was a groundbreaking moment. We knew that Europa didn't generate a magnetic field on its own, says Phillips, but the signal from Galileo indicated the existence of a material capable of carrying an electrical current. Conductive materials, like salt water, easily transmit electricity and produce an induced magnetic signal when they move through a magnetic field like Jupiter's. This was the biggest proof that there had to be a global layer of salty water below the surface of Europa, Phillips says. Ice alone couldn't carry this magnetic signal. It had to be liquid water. Life also needs energy and nutrients, not just water. Carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and nitrogen are life's building blocks, explains Phillips. These common elements likely exist on Europa with its rocky ocean floor. Tidal heating from Jupiter's gravity may also create hydrothermal vents on this seabed. If vents similar to those in Antarctica exist in Europa's ocean, they could create a warm, mineral-rich environment. Chemical reactions can be triggered when hot water meets seabed rocks, says Witasi. These interactions increase the chance to create complex molecules. This could make the bottom of Europa's ocean an important place to look for life. The largest moon and its secrets. The JUICE mission is mainly focused on Ganymede, Jupiter's largest moon, known for its magnetic field. Having a magnetic field is rare for moons, says Witasi. Usually, such fields are only found on planets or stars. The existence of this shield means that Ganymede likely has a liquid iron core. The magnetic shield protects this moon from Jupiter's powerful space radiation. Witasi compares this to Earth. Just like our magnetic fields shield us from the sun's radiation, Ganymedes could do the same, he says. This is vital for sustaining life. Understanding Ganymede's magnetic field is important. Investigating it could reveal a lot about Ganymede's inner structure, from the iron core to the icy shell, Witasi explains, possibly shedding light on its ability to support life. Ganymede also has a huge, salty ocean that's perhaps larger than all of Earth's oceans combined. NASA's Hubble Space Telescope supported this finding when it detected changes to Ganymede's magnetic field that were most easily explained by a vast and deep subsurface ocean. The water on Ganymede is estimated to lie about 150 kilometers, 93 miles, below the surface of the ice, Witasi explains. The JUICE mission is set to dig deeper into these discoveries. It aims to examine the ocean's composition, determine its size, and locate where its salts come from. Despite the presence of liquid water, Witasi points out, as Ganymede is further from Jupiter, it experiences weaker tidal effects and therefore less heating. He adds, though, that Ganymede's iron core still provides internal heat. Some scientists question Ganymede's ability to support life due to its ocean structure. Unlike Europa, Ganymede's ocean isn't touching a rocky seabed, Witasi explains. Instead, it is sandwiched between two ice layers. This means there's less opportunity for the chemical reactions needed for life. Witasi is excited about studying Jupiter and its moons, and he expects they'll learn a lot about our solar system. We have data to analyze for decades, he says. Unless something unexpected comes up, the JUICE mission will end in 2035 with a crash landing on Ganymede. Rachel Keough is a nonfiction writer from Burlington, Ontario, in Canada. She is excited by the possibilities of studying ocean worlds that could change our understanding of where life might exist, far beyond the confines of our home planet. Page 47, Your Tech by Catherine Hulick. Who owns the moon? India landed an uncrewed spacecraft on the moon for the first time in August 2023. Japan just reached the moon for the first time with a robotic spacecraft in January. And in 2026, the United States is set to land astronauts on the moon for the first time in more than half a century with its Artemis III mission. Exploration, research, and national prestige are all important goals for these missions. There's more to the new space race, however. Some companies hope to harvest and use the moon's water and precious minerals. So are they allowed to just fly up there and take whatever they want? That's a tricky question. The one thing almost everyone agrees on is that no one owns the moon or any other celestial body. In 1967, the United Nations General Assembly adopted an outer space treaty that has since been signed by almost every country in the world. The foundational concept of the law is that space is for everyone, Michelle Hanlon said in an interview with Boston radio station WBUR in September. Hanlon is a space lawyer. Yes, that's a real job at the University of Mississippi. The law clearly states that no nation can claim any part of space as their property. But it says nothing about private companies or whether it's okay to mine resources on the moon or elsewhere off Earth. Several other agreements attempt to resolve these types of questions. In 2015, President Barack Obama signed a law that says companies can't claim land on the moon, but they can take resources. Hanlon explains, if you extract the resource, it's yours. You own it. You can do whatever you want with it. In 2020, NASA developed the Artemis Accords, a set of principles meant to help moon explorers cooperate with one another. These principles say that it's okay to extract and use the moon's resources as long as you do so openly and not in secret. They also say that humanity's outer space heritage, including historically important landing sites, should be preserved. But not every country is on board with these agreements. Plus, some have argued that it's ethically wrong to alter the moon. I just don't think we have a right, Australian lawyer Michelle Maloney told Cosmos magazine in February 2023. She is a co-author of a legal treatise that aims to give the moon its own rights as a natural system. My deep ancestors saw the moon. In its simplest form, it is utter beauty, she said. Hanlon is more open to the use of moon resources, but she thinks it's wrong for a few powerful people to decide how we can explore space. These are decisions being made right now by a very small population of people on Earth about what's going to happen to the moon. And that's not fair, and that's not right. So, as a person of Earth, what's your opinion? How do you think we should explore the moon, and who should get to use its resources? Catherine Hulick thinks mining the moon may be the best way to build cities in space. But maybe we shouldn't start building things up there until we can care for Earth more sustainably. She explores these ideas in her book, Welcome to the Future, Quattro 2021. This has been Muse, the March 2024 edition. I'm Jane Malucci for Chris.